anybody there?
Now being recorded.
Hi, it's Dave Patman in Winnipeg.
Hi, and I'm sorry, who is it?
David Patman.
Oh, hi, how are you, David?
Good.
This is Kim.
Hi, Kim.
So I'm just waiting for other people to join us. It'll probably be a few minutes. So, you know, just feel free to kind of go and get a glass of water or a cup of tea or something, okay?
Will do.
Is anybody else on the line?
No, just me here.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
I'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Hi there.
Hello.
Hi, who's that?
Hi there, this is Catherine Somerville in the Office of the Chief Medical Officer of Health with Alberta Health.
Oh, hi, how are you?
Hi, good, how are you?
Fine, thank you. I'm glad that you're able to join us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for allowing us to listen in.
My pleasure. I'm sorry?
It's just me on our end here, so...
Okay, well, we're just waiting for other people to join us. There'll be about 35 people in total from across the country.
Okay, great.
So we're just kind of waiting for everybody to sign on. So it usually takes a few minutes. I'm surprised that there's not more people on the phone right now. But
was I the first?
I think you're like the second. Anyway, so just kind of go and get yourself a glass of water or something, but we'll just start in a few minutes, okay?
Wonderful. And is this Kim?
It is. It's Kim Perotta.
Oh, great. Well, great to meet you over the phone.
Yes, you too. Okay, hang on a few minutes, okay?
Absolutely.
Hello.
Hi, who's that?
Holly.
Hi, Holly. How are you?
Good. How are you, Kim?
Fine. Did you have troubles getting on today? I'm just curious.
No trouble at all.
Okay. It's just that there's very few people on the phone, and we're expecting about 35 or 40, so... I was worried that maybe it was just slow today, that sometimes people get tied up, like with an operator or something. Okay, so you're all set, Holly?
Yeah, I'm good to go.
Okay, so we just have to kind of sit back and wait for everybody else to join us, okay?
Sure, sounds good.
So is there anybody else on the phone right now besides Dave and Holly?
Yeah, it's Lisa Baldwin.
Oh, hi, Lisa.
From the Heart and Stroke Foundation.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Fine, you're in Winnipeg as well, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, great. Well, it's nice that you could join us.
Thank you.
We're just kind of waiting for everybody else to join. It's funny how usually everybody's on really fast, so it seems a little slower today, but we're still waiting for about another 30 people, so... You've got a minute
okay.
If you want to go and get a glass of water or get settled or anything, okay?
Okay. Are these presentations online or
Oh, yes,
after?
They are. Have you not got the presentations?
No.
Okay. So how we do this is we do it by teleconference. You go
okay.
into our website.
Yep.
And our website is
I'm on the website, yeah.
Okay. So you go to the knowledge translation page.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So if you clicked on that page.
Yep.
Okay, and is it coming up for you, or is it still password protected?
No, it's up.
Okay, it's up. If you go down, you scroll down near the, you'll see it's called bolded. I've got today's bolded, but they're all kind of, I've got them in order of the date. So if you kind of
okay.
go down, you'll see them, and all four of them are there. The first one up is going to be Holly with the rural active living assessment tool. So
yep,
she's
got it.
Okay. So you just kind of download them from there, okay?
Perfect, thank you.
Okay, great. And I'm sorry, the woman I was just speaking to from Alberta, I'm sorry, I forgot your first name. Oh, I guess she's kind of stepped off for a minute. Okay, is there anybody else on the line? Wow, slow today.
Hello, is anybody else there?
Hi, Steve Patton, still.
Still Dave. Hi, Dave. Anybody new on the phone? It's kind of strange. Usually people come on really quickly.
Yeah, I saw her on the email that it said come in like 10 minutes early, so.
Huh.
Like, I had no problem logging in or anything. It was easy.
And did you have troubles getting in on the phone, though?
Oh, no, it was simple.
Huh, it's weird, eh?
Yeah.
Well, it's just because I've got, like, I think 35 people have confirmed for today.
Okay.
And usually people are on a little faster than this, but weird. I'm just a little concerned, wondering if something's, yeah, I've got 33 confirmed. I think there's only about 5 of us on the phone right now.
Winnipeg's here.
Hi.
Hi.
So are all of you there together?
Sheila and I, this is Sarah. Sheila and Sarah here, and Deanna will be joining us shortly. I believe Lisa's dialing from home.
Okay, well, that's great. Okay, well, it's nice that you joined us. We're still, people seem to be slow getting on today. It's surprising. Usually there's more people on the phone at this point, but we're waiting for there's supposed to be about 35.
I guess it's the Tuesday after a long weekend.
No, everybody's just a little bit in slow gear today. Is there anybody else on the phone who hasn't kind of spoken up yet? Well, we have our first speaker and 5 people to listen.
I won't take it personally.
I'm sure other people come on. Did you guys have trouble getting through those? Like, I know at times, sometimes if there's too many people trying to phone in at once, sometimes it can slow down the system, but you guys didn't have troubles getting through?
Not here in Winnipeg, no.
Okay. Is there anybody new on the phone who hasn't signed in or said hello yet?
This is Ian from CITE. I've just signed in.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Have you got the presentations all right?
Yes, I'm logged in.
Okay. We're just waiting for everybody to join us. People seem to be a little slow joining in today.
Okay. Hi.
Hi, who's this? I'm sorry?
Céline and Sophie from Montreal.
Great. Hi. I'm glad to have you both here. That's terrific. Okay. We're just kind of waiting for people. Everybody seems to be coming on a little slower today. So we're just kind of waiting in for everybody. And Céline, you guys were able to access the presentations on the web, okay?
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
Now, I hear a little bit of static from somebody's line that's just come on. Is somebody on a cordless phone, maybe, or? No? Okay. Okay, folks, I'm going to wait for a few more minutes. And can I just check, like, my computer is saying 106. What time do other people have it there at your ends? Is my computer a little fast, perhaps?
A little bit fast, yeah.
Like, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not quite noon in Winnipeg yet.
Okay, so we're okay then. So we'll just wait for a few more minutes, okay, and let a few other people sign on, okay? Have we got anybody new on the phone? I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
Andrea Simpson? Yeah.
Andrea, I can hardly hear you.
Okay, I'll try to fix my headset. Is that better?
Yeah, I don't think it's you. Céline and Sophie, when you guys signed in, are you guys on a conference, a speakerphone by any chance? Céline, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, you're pretty clear. It's funny. Since you guys have called, there's a little bit of a hum on the phone, but it may just be a coincidence with you guys.
Okay, so it's clear for us.
Okay, you can hear okay?
Yes.
Okay.
Perfectly.
I'm Hilda Chow from Ottawa Public Health, and maybe it's since I signed on, because I'm actually, I'm on a cell phone.
Okay. Well, I'm going to be muting the phones when we get the presentation going, so, you know, it shouldn't be a problem, but can you hear us okay?
Yes, I can hear you clearly. Thank you.
Okay, that's great. Okay, and then I'm just curious, do we have Michael on the phone yet? Nope. Okay. Anybody else new who has signed in yet?
Ryan Edwards Whitney, Toronto Centre for Active Transportation.
Okay, so we've got Ryan from TCAT, and I'm sorry, who was the other person?
Hi, this is Alexandra from the Montreal Urban Ecology Centre.
Oh, it's nice to have you on here, Alexandra.
And Gail, go ahead. Gail Bercy from Peel Health has arrived.
Hi, Gail, how are you?
Hi, good, thanks.
And who was the other person?
It's Megan from Regina.
Oh, hi, Megan.
Hi, Kim.
We're just waiting for people to sign on. Anybody else new who hasn't spoken up yet?
Helena.
Oh, Helena, hi. Now, Helena, I can hardly hear you. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. And everybody's able to get the presentations all right? How about anybody having problems getting to the presentations?
It's Gail, I did, but I don't have an admin today, and I just have been in meetings. Can you just tell me, if we're waiting, where I go, please?
Yeah, oh, you know what, do you know how to get into our website, hcbd-clasp, so it's, if you know what the, have you got the calendar invite in front of you?
Yes.
If you go in there and you click on there, it takes you right to the page, and then if you have to put in a password, it's just HCBD for Healthy Canada by Design.
Okay, thank you.
And then you scroll down the page and look for the date, and the four presentations are there.
Perfect, thank you.
Okay, anybody else having problems with the presentations? Okay, and Michael, have we got our third speaker, Michael, on the phone? Not yet.
Hi, Kim.
Hi, and who's that?
It's Allie from Halifax.
Hi, Allie. How are you?
Oh, how are you?
Good. Anybody else new on the phone who hasn't spoken up yet?
Inga from Ottawa.
Hi. Oh, Inga, you're as clear as a bell.
Am I?
Some people, like, Helena actually sounds like she's on the other side of the country, but you sound like you're in the next room, for goodness sake. Well, that's good to hear you.
Just down the road from you, Kim.
Yeah, right. And any sign of Michael, our third speaker, yet? Michael, are you on the phone yet? No? Okay. Anybody else new who hasn't spoken up yet?
Yeah, this is Maggie Linton for Publisher Health Promotion and Innovation Division.
Oh, are you with Public Health Agency?
The Public Health Agency, that's right.
Okay, that's great. Okay, most of the people on the phone are with health authorities in different provinces, and then we have a few people who are with our national partners, CITE or CIP, Transportation Engineers or Planning. Okay?
Perfect. Thank you.
And we also have a guest from Alberta today, which is terrific.
Hi, Kim.
And Kim?
Yes?
This is Karen Lee.
Hi, Karen. And I'm sorry, who was that?
It's Olivier from the NCCHPP.
Hi. And you know, you're not coming through very clearly either, but can you hear us okay?
Yeah, I can hear you perfectly.
Okay, that's great. And then have we got our speaker, Michael, on the phone yet? We may start without Michael because he's the second speaker, but how are we doing for anybody else who has signed on who hasn't said anything yet?
John Carsley from Vancouver.
Okay, great. Hi, John.
Hello. Very good job from St. John.
Okay, great.
Can I ask about the password, please? Is it all lowercase?
Yes, it is. And it's just lowercase HCBD for Healthy Canada by Design. Okay, and if anybody's having troubles downloading, I can send the four presentations on share file by email if you send me an email. Or if you want to just tell me, and I know your email. Most of you, I know your emails. Okay.
Sure, could I get an email sent to me?
Yeah, who is that?
It's for Maggie Linton with the Public Health Agency of Canada.
And I'm just going to give another minute or two, you guys, to see if we can get our, give a few people a little bit more time.
Kim, can you remind me how to mute the lines once it starts?
You know what? Yes. So everybody, you can mute your own lines with *4, and you can unmute your own line with *4. I will be muting everybody's lines as soon as we get the presentations underway, but you can mute your own line at any time with *4.
Thank you.
I'm just putting everybody...
Maggie?
Yes.
Can you tell me your what did your email start with?
Actually, I'm just trying to get the presentation. It seems to be working now. It wasn't for the longest time. So I inputted the password, and where do I find the presentation?
Scroll down. There, like all the presentations are there, or like over, like as they chronologically.
Yeah.
If you kind of go down the page, it's all bolded. You'll see I've kind of bolded today, but if you kind of go down chronologically, you'll see them there. And the first one is...
Oh, there, I got it.
Okay, the first one is the one by New Brunswick, by Holly.
Perfect.
Michael, any sign of you yet on the phone? Okay. I think we're going to get started. I think our second speaker will sign on.
So just before we get started, just, you know, a little bit of housekeeping. Just a reminder that we are recording these sessions, and so anybody who couldn't make it today who would like to look at the presentations or listen to the recording, they will be on the website as of tomorrow. And just in terms of housekeeping again, so just *4 is for muting and unmuting your own line, but I will be muting everybody's lines when the speakers are on. I'll be unmuting them during the questions and answers, and if everybody could be clear not to have any conversations in front of your phone during these presentations. Somebody last time didn't realize I'd unmuted, and they were having a conversation while we were trying to do questions and answers. So if everybody could be careful of that, please do not put your phone on hold while we're on the teleconference. If you need to leave the room, and just hit *4 if you'd like to mute your phone. And let's see, is there anything else? Just, I think everybody else knows that this is a teleconference for Healthy Canada by Design. I'm Kim Parada. I work for Heart and Stroke Foundation, and the Healthy Canada by Design initiative is funded by the Canadian Partnership Against Cancer. And today we have three speakers, and the format of the day, we actually have four speakers from three organizations. The format we'll be using is we're going to allow them to speak for 15 minutes. They'll present with their presentations, and then we're going to open it for discussion from 5 to 15 minutes, whatever feels comfortable, and then we'll move to the next speaker. And I think that's it. And so the very first presentation will be Holly Owens from New Brunswick. The second one will be Michael Williston from Red Deer. The third one will be Sophie Paquin from Montreal Public Health. Okay, so I'm going to just mute all the phones now, and then I will introduce Holly, okay? So here we go.
Kim, sorry, just to interrupt, it's Maggie again. For some reason, the website on my end is frozen, so I can't follow the presentation.
Okay.
Are you able to email it to me?
I can. Can you just tell me your email address?
Yeah, Maggie.Linton, so Maggie, M-A-G-G-I-E, dot L-I-N-T-O-N, at phac-aspc.gc.ca.
Okay, I'm going to try that, but it might be easier for me if you send me an email. Have you got my email on the calendar invite?
I don't know.
Okay, well, I'll try and send that to you. I'm going to get things going, though, okay?
Sure,
I'll see what I can do, okay?
The conference is now in silent mode.
Hi, folks. So in terms of Holly Owens, Holly is an associate and professional planner with Dillon Consulting. Holly has more than 8 years of experience as a land use planner with a focus on municipal policy development, sustainable community planning, and public consultation. More recently, her work has begun to focus on healthy community planning, highlighting the linkages between the built environment and health outcomes, and how communities can develop land use policy that better supports community health. Holly is currently one of our class facilitators, and she works with the New Brunswick Department of Health. So, Holly, I'll pass things over to you.
Okay, great. Thanks, Kim. Am I coming through okay?
I can hear you just fine.
Okay, perfect. So thanks for the intro and the opportunity to speak today to share a little bit about the work we've been doing with the RALA tool as part of the New Brunswick CLASP initiative. As Kim mentioned, I'm the facilitator with the New Brunswick class project. And just for a little bit of background information, our team is made up of two staff members from the New Brunswick Office of the Chief Medical Officer of Health, which is part of the New Brunswick Department of Health, or NB Health as we call it for short. And then there's also two medical officers of health who are involved as well. So a lot of our class work is happening at the provincial level. And we're working on four major projects, one of which is the RALA Tools pilot project. So you can go to the next slide, which is titled Outline. So this is what I wanted to talk about in my 15 minutes. I'm just going to start with a little bit of background on the origin of the RALA tools, where they came from, then a brief overview of the tools themselves. Then I want to talk a little bit about how we've taken those tools and adapted them to the Canadian and New Brunswick context. And then I'll give you an overview of our pilot project, which is in progress. And then I'll outline what we've identified for our next steps, and then hopefully a bit of time for questions and discussion. And just for information, I threw a couple pictures up on this slide that just show some of the examples of some of the types of challenges that we see in rural areas when it comes to being physically active. So things like roads with no shoulders, schools located on community edges, challenges with walking to school, that type of stuff. So you can go to the next slide, which is titled Background. So as many of you probably know, there aren't a huge number of tools out there that focus on health in the built environment, specifically in rural areas. And in New Brunswick, about half of our 750,000 people live in rural areas. So as part of our class project, it was really important to our team that we do some work that was specific to rural communities. So in developing our action plan, we came across the Rural Active Living Assessment Tools, or RALA tools for short. And the design of these tools, they were developed by a fellow named Dr. David Hartley out of the University of Southern Maine in partnership with the Active Living Research Organization. And this organization is actually a national program out of an American national program out of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And their primary goal is to support and share research on environmental and policy strategies that can promote daily physical activity for children and families across the U.S. And Active Living Research, it's administered by the University of California, San Diego. And I've included the link to their website at the bottom of this slide and the next slide. You can find the original RALA tools on that website, but there's also some other great resources on there, including a series of infographics that highlight the role of various built environment components and health, and I've got some samples of those on the slide there. So the RALA tools are basically a set of easy-to-use checklist designed specifically for communities with populations of 10,000 people or less to help assess how activity-friendly those communities are. So the tools are designed to help rural communities collect data on built environment features and amenities, community characteristics, community programs, and policies that could potentially influence levels of physical activity among residents. So the tools were originally developed through the University of Southern Maine, as I mentioned, and that work started back in 2005. And then the tools were tested and refined by researchers at Tufts University, the University of Alabama, and the University of Mississippi. So there's actually been a lot of work that's gone into the development of these tools. So you can go to the next slide, which is titled RALA Tools. So there are actually three RALA tools. There's a townwide assessment, a programs and policies assessment, and a street segment assessment. And the tools are essentially a series of checklists. So the townwide assessment provides a structure for looking at the community as a whole, how it's laid out, where people live, work, and go to school, and how they're likely to get from one place to another. The programs and policies tool provides a structure for assessing the programs and policies that are in place that might help to overcome an unfriendly environment, or that might actually make that environment less activity friendly. And then the street segment tool is a detailed tool that rural communities can use to look at specific segments of the community and then assess the key characteristics of those segments, things like their walkability and the mix of land uses that are present, that type of thing. Now, beyond the RALA tools themselves, the University of Southern Maine also developed two other pieces that go along with the RALA tools, and that's a code book and a scoring tool. So the code book, it's basically a user guide, so it gives instructions and an overview of the tools and also provides question-by-question details for completing each of the three assessment tools. And then the scoring tool, basically it assigns points to answers to each of the assessment questions and then allows the user to obtain an overall score, and that applies to the community or the town-wide tool and also the programs and policy assessment tool. And the idea then is that that information can be used as baseline information, so a community can use that info to track their changes or progress over time, or they can also use it to compare themselves to other communities that might have used the tools. You can go to the next slide, which is titled Adaptation. So once we decided that we'd like to test pilot the RALA tools here in New Brunswick, we knew that the first step was going to be to Canadianize the RALA tools, for lack of a better word. Fortunately for us, a couple of the other class teams are also interested in using the RALA tools. So we teamed up with the Newfoundland and Regina class facilitators to basically review the tools as a group and suggest and come up with changes that would make them just better fit the rural Canadian context. And just some examples of the changes that we made. We made quite a few changes to some of the nomenclature in the tools. So, for example, we changed the name of the town-wide assessment to community-wide assessment, removed references to things like counties, changed measurement units from imperial to metric, changed some of the terminology with respect to recreational facilities, and then we also added a few things as well. For example, with respect to facilities, added ice arenas and taking a look at social gathering places, that type of thing. We also included more of an age-friendly focus. So the original RALA tools were very youth-oriented, but since rural populations in New Brunswick, Saskatchewan, and Newfoundland are generally aging, we felt it was important that we try to pull in some questions that would focus on that demographic as well. Also, the code book includes examples and pictures, so for example, of various residential densities. So we ended up replacing some of the photo examples just so that they would better reflect local context. And then the other big piece was that here in New Brunswick, because the pilot project is a provincial project, we also translated the RALA tools and all the accompanying documents into French. So we have basically full English and French versions of everything. So after we did our tweaking to the RALA tools, our next step here in New Brunswick was to pull together our pilot project package. So this included the revised RALA tools, code book and scoring tool, but we also developed a number of other components. So we put together a list of instructions for our RALA pilot project partners to help them walk through the package and fill out and do all the work. We also put together a one-page reporting form to help our pilot project partners summarize their results from doing the assessments, helping them think about, you know, where are the areas where we're doing really well, where are the areas where we could improve, what are some of the types of steps that we could take to start doing some of those improvements, that type of thing. And then the final piece was, once we identified our partner communities, which I'll talk about on the next slide, was we also pulled together a series of health statistics to give to each of our pilot project partners as a bit of a snapshot of the health of their communities. And the stats were specifically related to physical activity and chronic diseases associated with obesity. And we really felt this was important, you know, to include this information because it reinforces those linkages between the RALA assessment, which is looking at the built environment and the programming environment, and those health outcomes. You can go to the next slide, which is titled Pilot Project. So just to step back for a second, in New Brunswick, the purpose of test piloting the RALA tools is to use and evaluate the usefulness and the applicability of the RALA tools at assessing the physical features, community programs, and policies that promote physical activity in the rural communities of New Brunswick. So the idea was to partner with four rural communities here in the province, have them use the RALA tools and evaluate their usefulness, and then NB Health will evaluate the results of the pilot projects with the goal of revising the tools if necessary and then rolling them out to rural communities across the province. So first step for us was issuing a call for expressions of interest, and this call was sent out via email to all of the CAOs across the province as well as to all of our regional service commissions, and those are basically regional bodies that are responsible for local planning in a lot of the rural areas in our province. And we received about 10 responses back, which was pretty decent. And from those, we selected our four partner communities, which you can see up on the slide there. And part of the rationale for selecting these communities was that there was quite a bit of variety in the population size and density, which means that allows us to test the applicability of the RALA tools in a variety of settings. So just to give you an idea of the variation, the local service district of Kingston, which is second from the bottom there, is our most rural community that we're working with. It's got a population of about 3,600 people, but they're spread out over 260 square kilometers, which works out to a population density of basically 14 people per square kilometer, so very rural. The village of Black's Harbor is a coastal town or coastal village in southern New Brunswick with a population of about 1,000, and that's spread out over 9 square kilometers, which works out to about 112 people per square kilometer. Then we have the village of Rogersville, which is an inland community, about kind of central, I guess, in the province. It has a population of about 1,200 people over 7 square kilometers, which is a density of 167 people per square kilometer. And then our most densely populated community is the town of Dalhousie, which is right in the northern part of the province. And they have a population of about 3,500 spread over 14 square kilometers, which works out to about 240 people per square kilometer. So you can see there's quite a spread there. In terms of actual process, we're following the same steps in each of our partner communities. So the first step was an initial face-to-face meeting, and basically the purpose of that meeting was introductions, overview of the tools and the pilot project package, questions, discussion, and setting target dates for completing the work and for the next meeting. Step two is the pilot project community is actually carrying out the assessment and completing the information in the package. And then step three is meeting number two, which is a review, which is again a face-to-face meeting to review the results of the tools and to go through what they've identified for next steps, et cetera. And then step four is that each of our partner communities when they came on board, committed to giving a presentation to their council or regional service commission to talk about the pilot project and share the results and next steps, and the idea being that NB Health will be in attendance for each of those presentations. So you can go to the next slide, which is next steps. So right now we're about halfway through our process. So unfortunately, I don't actually have any results to share with this group yet. However, we've had our first meetings with each of the four partners, and each of the partners is currently off carrying out the work. The initial meetings all went really well. They were a really good relationship-building opportunity for the NB Health folks to sit down and actually do some work with counterparts at the municipal level. The partner communities they're really excited about the RALA tools, and they're already talking about how they might be useful as baseline work for future active transportation and or recreation planning, and also how they could be used as a tool that could help inform their capital spending and budgets going forward. So we have most of our second meetings and a couple of our council presentations are scheduled, and that the partner work should be completed by the end of October, mid-November-ish at the latest. And then the next piece is the NB class team then will be spending some time evaluating the results of the pilot project, possibly making further changes to the RALA tools, and then looking at developing plans to roll the RALA tools out province-wide. And I just realized that I forgot to talk about one of the components of our pilot project package that we put together was Natalie Kishchuk, who's with CLASS as well, helped us develop basically like an assessment questionnaire to help our pilot project communities, once they've completed the tools, to stop and think a little bit about how they found using the tools. Was it useful? Were there words they didn't understand or the things that they would change? Would they recommend the tool to other communities? That type of thing. So that information is going to be really important, a really important piece of helping NB Health figure out what changes might need to be made to the tools to make them more applicable to the New Brunswick context. And you can go to the next slide, which is the last slide. So that's about it. I think we have time for questions or comments, so I guess I'll hand it back to Kim to facilitate that.
Hi, folks. I'm going to just unmute everybody, okay?
The conference is now in talk mode.
Okay, so everybody's been unmuted, and so we're going to take some questions. And does anybody have a question, just off the top of their heads right now?
Claire Graham from Vancouver. Sounds like great work. Thank you for sharing it. What my question is the whole pilot project owned by the local government, or is there any staff support from NB New Brunswick in implementing the pilot beyond the evaluation and setting them up at the beginning?
So the way we set it up, that's a great question. Thanks, Claire. The way we set it up, just because the NB Health folks are swamped, as you can imagine, is that the partner communities are responsible for actually going out and doing the work, but the NB Health staff have committed to be available if our partner communities have questions as they're going along or if they're unsure of anything. I'm available as well. So we're available as a resource, but the communities are actually taking on and doing the work themselves at this stage.
Holly, this is Kim. I wonder if you could give us an example, like one or two examples of the kinds of questions that are in the tool.
Yeah, sure. I have it right in front of me. So, for example, in the community assessment tool, the first part of it is just sort of general questions about the size of the area of the community, the population density, topography, that type of stuff, street patterns, etc. And then there's a section on educational facilities. So is there a school located in the community, yes or no? If there is, what type of school and where is it located with respect to the community center? So just stepping back for a second, in the community assessment tool, the first step that the community has to do is identify what they consider as their community center. And in the code book that goes along with the tools, there's a bunch of guidance on how to go about doing that. But it is it's a subjective exercise, so it's what you feel fits best in your community. And then what happens is a lot of the questions with respect to the location of facilities will relate back to distance to what you've identified as the community center. So if there's an elementary school, for example, is it within 1 kilometer or less of the community center? Is it more than 5 kilometers from the community center, that type of thing? And then they ask a whole series of questions about different types of recreational facilities. So, for example, are there biking paths? And then, yes, within 1 kilometer of the center, yes, within 1.5 kilometers of the center, yes, so a whole variety of yeses based on distance. And then they also will ask questions about, well, what's the condition of those biking paths? Is it Are they in poor condition? Are they in very good condition? And then there are also questions about access to those facilities. So are those facilities clearly marked? Is there good signage? Are there sidewalks or trails leading to that facility or amenity? Is there any kind of transit? Is there designated parking? That type of thing. So there's quite a few pages on recreational facilities. And then, so that's, I guess, an example of the town-wide. And then in programs and policies, that assessment tool, there's a lot of focus on community programs versus school programs. So questions about, you know, are school facilities available for public use outside of school hours, as an example. Is there physical activity programming for local youth? Is there programming for local adults? Is there programming for seniors? I won't go through it all, but so you can see there's quite a broad range of questions. The idea with the tools is that they're meant to be quite easy to use. If you knew your community quite well, you could sit down and do the tool probably in a few hours. It's a little bit more challenging if you're filling out the tool in a community that you're not necessarily familiar with.
Thank you.
This is Karen. I'm wondering, Holly, if you can speak to who within the communities are being involved in the assessments and the filling out of these tools. Is it the local health authority? Is it the planning department? Does it vary? Like, how is it being done within the communities?
Sure. That's a great question, Karen. So we have a bit of variety amongst our four partners about who's doing the actual work. I should say that the tools are designed to be pretty user-friendly so that you don't necessarily need to be a planning professional or a public health professional to fill out the tool. You could be the local planner, or you could be an interested community member or someone from a nonprofit group. There's no special expertise required. With our partners, I believe 3 out of 4, the work is being completed by the local, whether it's a CAO or town manager, as it were. So it's local municipal staff that are doing the work. And the fourth partner, which is our most rural partner, is the local service district of Kingston. And the way the rural governance model works in New Brunswick is that the LSC of Kingston falls under a regional service commission, and that service commission is responsible for carrying out the local planning. So the lead person who's doing the work on that project is actually the director of that regional service commission, but she is completing the tools with the help of 2 or 3 members from the Kingston LSC community, who have been kind of leaders on recreation files and activities in the past. So in that model, where she's not as familiar with the community, she's actually directly engaging some folks from the community to help her do the work.
Great, thank you.
Can I just, this is Megan from Regina, can I just add to that? Because ours is a little bit different in who's actually working with us, so I just wanted to add that we have our community action specialist from the Heart and Stroke Foundation of Canada, who is going to be working with the Regina-Qu'Appelle Health Region health professionals on that. We also have pulled in our rural health educators to work with the elected officials within each community that has been designated. And we have Joy and myself that are going to be working on that as well. So it's a little bit, we didn't have the expression of interest. We've actually had communities approach us and saying, we'd like to be a part of this. So I think for the first step, we're really taking those that are already engaged. So I just wanted to add to that, Holly. Thank you.
Thanks, Megan.
And Megan, can you just tell us a little bit about how many communities you have doing it in Saskatchewan?
Currently, we have 2 that we've been in contact with, but we're hoping to get 1 more, and 1 more that would be quite different than the current 2 that we have. Our communities are very, very small, so we're looking at potentially getting a First Nations community or a resort village or both. So these are the 2 that we're exploring on top of the 2 that have already approached us, actually, from our Growing Healthy Communities Forum.
Thank you. And, sorry?
Oh, and through our rural health educators.
Great.
Great.
Newfoundland, do you want to add anything to what's been said?
No, we're just going to get started with ours now. Later on this month, I'll be introducing the tool to a meeting of the regional wellness coalitions on the west coast of the province. And we're going to try and have them sort of sign up to test the tool back in their communities. And we've got Eastern Health here as well. We've been working with their public health people to test it in some of the communities on the eastern side of the province. So it's really just kind of getting started here.
Okay. Any other questions for Holly?
Hi, Holly. This is...
Oops, I think it sounds like we've got two. So one of you go first, and we'll get to the other one.
So, go ahead. This is Helena. Do you want me to go first or whoever, the other person?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So I noticed that I looked up the stuff by David Hartley. I noticed that it's in 2000 and was made in 2009. And I wonder whether that particular researcher or whether you guys had some thoughts about incorporating some of the newer, well, not even all of it's newer, but broadening the depth of the tool. Like, the tool itself is really neat and simple, and I it's a great work, but there's some stuff around, for example, that walking school buses in some environments may not work because it's just too far. There's information that lower speeds may actually really, for vehicles, might encourage walking and cycling. There's information about pedestrianizing the downtowns of small towns to encourage walking and that kind of thing. Is there going to be an effort to update or modernize that aspect of the tool?
And before you answer, Holly, can I just ask, I'm sorry, who was that was asking the question?
Helena Swinkles from...
Oh, I'm sorry, Helena. I didn't quite catch who was talking. Okay, thanks, Helena. Holly?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Helena. That's a really good question and some really good points, actually. We haven't, other than the kind of initial assessment of the tools that we did in concert with the Newfoundland and Regina folks, haven't gone too far down the road of thinking about significant changes to the tools, but that is certainly going to happen once we've got our results back from the four pilot projects. The NB Health folks and I will be sitting down to really think about, okay, are there big pieces that we're missing here, you know, in terms of making these tools as useful as they can be for the New Brunswick context, but also to your point, to make sure that we are incorporating, you know, the kind of the most current trends in terms of good planning practices for a healthy built environment to help facilitate increased physical activity. So it's that's a really good point.
That could be very, very helpful. Thank you very much.
Any other questions for Holly before we move on?
I have a last question. It's Alexandra from Montreal, and I was wondering when you selected the different communities, if there was any kind of criteria that they committed to improve the active transportation infrastructure, or what other kind of selection criteria you had?
Yeah, thanks, Alexandra. That's a good question. We struggled a little bit beforehand about whether or not we should set, you know, really detailed selection criteria, but we didn't know if we'd get any responses at all, so we thought, let's just wait and see who responds and then take it from there. And really, we knew that one of the big pieces is that we wanted to try and get as much variety as we could amongst our partner communities to try to test the tool in as many different scenarios as we could, because, you know, while essentially half the population in New Brunswick lives in rural communities, there's quite a bit of variety in terms of the form and density of those rural communities. You know, that was part of it. Also, New Brunswick, we're a bilingual province, so we wanted to make sure that we had some Acadian or Francophone communities involved. So that was part of the criteria. We have two of our partner communities are actually using the French version of the tools, which is excellent. You know, part of the other piece is that if you look at our four partner communities, Two of them have already shown some interest in this type of work in the past and done some infrastructure investment here and there. And the other two really haven't done anything yet but are interested in it. So even that, we thought there was value in that context as well, having some people that already have the ball rolling and some people that are trying to get the ball rolling. I'm just trying to think. I think those were some of the main things that we talked about when we were narrowing down the candidates.
Thank you very much, Holly. I think we have to move on to our next presenter. Can I just check to see if Michael's on the phone, our next speaker? Are you on the phone?
Yes, we're here.
Excellent. I was afraid that we'd lost you there. Okay, so I'm just going to mute the phones, and then I'll introduce our next two speakers. And, Michael, you are on the host line. Is that right?
Yes.
Great. Okay, hang on a sec, folks.
The conference is now in silent mode.
Okay, folks, so we've got two speakers presenting to us, and this is a presentation from Red Deer, so if you're going into the other presentations, it's kind of a beige and white presentation. It's with Red Deer on the front. So Michael Williston is a registered professional engineer in both Canada and the United States. He's worked for construction contractors, consulting engineering firms, and municipalities, and has been involved in a variety of projects ranging from high-rise building construction to greenfield land development. Michael has been the transportation engineer for the City of Red Deer for over 5 years, and he is joined by Lorna Milkovich, who is the executive director of the Red Deer Primary Care Network. Lorna received a bachelor degree in nursing and a master's in business administration. Her nursing career has spanned rural nursing, intensive care, outpatient hypertension clinic to psychiatry, and she has been leading the Red Deer Primary Care Network for over 6 years now. So we'll turn things over to Michael and to Lorna.
Thank you very much, Kim, and good morning or good afternoon, everyone, as the case may be. So today we're going to talk about the bike pilot project here in Red Deer. If you flip to slide 2, that'll give you an overview of what we're going to discuss. It's basically this pilot's been going on since 2011, but what I'll cover first is a few quick facts about Red Deer, the objectives of the pilot, who some of the stakeholders were throughout the process, an overview of the pilot itself, as well as some specific challenges and lessons learned over the past couple years. Also, we have sitting in with us here today in Red Deer is Simone Thompson. She's a project coordinator designer with the city, and she was a key designer throughout the entire pilot process. So if you turn to slide 3, here's some particulars about Red Deer. Red Deer is located smack dab in the middle between Calgary and Edmonton, basically a one-hour drive between the two cities. We're over 97,000 residents. We're actually located in a river valley, and downtown is kind of our low point. So all of our residential areas, you have to climb quite a significant ridge out of the downtown to get to our residential areas. And as you can see at the bottom of the slide there, the average age in Red Deer is 32, so we're a relatively young community as well. We turn to slide 4. Here's the three key objectives that we had for the pilot. We wanted to expand our existing on-street facilities, which really weren't very much. We had a few roadways in our downtown that had sharrows. You may be familiar with that term. Basically a shared vehicle and cycling lane. We wanted to create better cycling connections throughout the city, and we also wanted to test a variety of on-street bicycle facilities to see what might work best in our community. The council-approved budget for this project is $800,000, which is, it seems like a lot, but when we get into the particulars of how large the scope and scale of this project was, it's not enough, let's just put it that way. One of the other key things that we had to consider throughout was the method of implementation. Because it's a pilot, we were committed to trying things out, but we don't really know what the future of this is. So we had to make sure that any removal or restoration of our roadways to their previous configuration would be possible, and it would be possible with minimal damage to the roadways and minimal cost. So how we achieved that was basically painting everything instead of doing more permanent roadway marking type treatments. Some of you might be familiar with the term thermoplastic. So when you use paint, it wears off. So that was a challenge, as well as we didn't modify our curbs. We had to work within our existing roadways, so we didn't widen our roads or anything like that. You flip over to slide 5. Here's a listing of the stakeholders that were involved in the pilot since 2011. Basically, these stakeholders were the members of the steering committee that helped guide the project. And involving our partner organizations down at the bottom of the slide there really allowed for active participation of these groups throughout the pilot planning, as well as ongoing feedback from an experienced user group. And that's sort of the skill set we were hoping would be brought to this pilot project. It's easy to sit in an office and look at design standards and guidelines and come up with a plan, but ongoing feedback is critical. And as Kim was saying, Lorna, the executive director of the Red Deer Primary Care Network, is here, and maybe she can provide some perspective of how she felt the steering committee went.
For sure. For a quick start, the Red Deer Primary Care Network is a healthcare organization that's involved in primary healthcare. And as we know, these cities and municipalities have been involved in health for decades now. We just didn't call it that before. And so it's just been in the last, probably this project was one of our first major connections with the city of Red Deer. And what we were really looking to do was promote cycling and promote health, as I think the other organizations that were involved here. The neat thing that we really found, I guess I can just speak for the Red Deer Primary Care Network and what I saw from this collaboration, was that these groups all came in with their own different angles from different perspectives, but very much the process that we had gone through very much aligned our goals and created synergies to carry this project forward. And there's many other things connected with it that I won't get into, but it really involved promoting cycling in Red Deer in general, and this was part of that whole project.
Thanks, Lorna. If we flip to slide 6, here we're getting into sort of the meat on the bones. 2011 was a year of quick wins. We got off to a bit of a late start in the pilot, but we wanted to get some things on the ground. We wanted to start the pilot in 2011. So this map shows you the areas where we installed dedicated bike lanes for the most part. There's a few areas where it's a share the road type treatment, but for the most part it's all dedicated bike lanes. And what I mean by a quick win is basically we didn't have to modify the existing roadway markings. These are all roadways that were quite wide, and all we had to do was either paint a stencil down the side of an existing shoulder or paint a lane line on the edge of the roadway to designate the space for cyclists. And it still left plenty of room for motorists, and it really did not impact existing traffic patterns in any way. So these red lines on the slides here amounts to about 4 kilometers of bike lanes on roadways in Red Deer, which was a brand new thing in 2011. Had never really been done to that level before. We did have an online survey that people could feed or fill out in 2011, and the feedback was very positive. And building on that, we went right straight into 2011. Or 2012, sorry. If you switch to slide 7, here's a bit of an overview of what we did in 2012. As you can see, the focus changed to a continuous and connected system, trying to deliver on those pilot objectives that I started off talking about. Also, the steering committee kind of renewed its focus. Instead of just trying to come up with a network, there was a round-the-table recognition that just putting things on the ground wasn't going to be good enough. And as a group, we focused on education, encouragement, engineering, evaluation, and enforcement to try to pull together a pilot that would be meaningful and successful. And to that end, the steering committee membership was broken into subcommittees, each one with responsibility for one of those 5 E's. And we worked separately in our subcommittee groups, and we reported back to the subcommittee as a whole. As a result, we came up with a network that added an additional 16 kilometers of cycling infrastructure on roadways, and We wanted to install it as early as possible. Again, there was a lot of planning that went into this. We got off to a late start again in the construction season. We had a particularly harsh winter, I think, that season. And the goal was to get everything installed early in the summer so that people could take advantage of the summer riding season, as well as getting things installed before school was in, because some of our proposed routes went by a number of schools. So if you flip to slide 8, you can see what our network in 2012 looked like. This is basically what was installed by the end of August. Most of this is bike lanes. There are some areas that are bike routes or share the road treatment, but it's quite extensive, and it connects the north of the city to the south of the city, as well as east and west. And we really wanted to make things that connected to our existing trail system, as well as carried through the downtown, because that was identified as a key destination point. It is, after all, a commuter cyclist pilot initiative. So we rolled this out. School started. You may notice on the map at the corner of 40th Avenue and 55th Street, it's a little bit of a curve. Well, at the west side of that curve, there's three different schools. There's a public high school. There's a Catholic school, which I think is K to 9. And there's another school in the area that's K to 12. So overall, you have three schools that have over 2,500 students. So there was congestion in this area before we ever started the pilot, and certainly as a result of our modifications, people felt that there was an increase to the congestion, and we had a lot of feedback right off the bat. As a result, we went back to council, and we modified our network, and it was modified in the following way. If you look at slide 9, you can see the two areas blocked off. So you see the whole area, 55th Street and a portion of 40th, that was actually completely removed as a result of public feedback. And I'll show you some cross-sections of this later on in the presentation so you get an understanding of what we did there. As well as in the northwest corner, you see a big circle around an area. That's in a residential zone where we had installed bike lanes, but there was on-street parking there before. And people didn't like the fact that the on-street parking was removed, and so we were directed to change it to a share the road treatment. So it's still part of the overall network, but not dedicated bike lanes. Now if you switch to slide 10, basically 2013, we were learning on an ongoing basis. The previous map shows you what was in place over the winter of 2012-2013, and it definitely created some challenges. Number one, with the removals in 2012, we had a bit of a disconnected system. We no longer had that looping. By chopping out 55th Street and 40th Avenue, a portion of it, we kind of stranded cyclists to a degree. Also, the temporary nature of the construction did create winter issues. Like I said, we put everything down in paint, and paint doesn't last, especially when it gets wet. We had fading paint lines. We had areas where we actually shifted the center lines of the roadways to accommodate bike lanes, and that became particularly problematic for drivers in the winter when they were covered with snow or faded out. We certainly had all the proper signage to go with it, but we did learn that people rely on the markings even more than they do the signage. So based on the feedback we heard throughout the winter, our own observations, and some things that we just thought didn't make sense anymore because of the changes in 2012, we modified our network in 2013, and that's shown on slide 11. As you can see, the portion of 40th Avenue all the way down to 39th Street, that sort of L-shaped box, we ended up removing that. Again, I'll show you some cross-sections of what that looks like in just a minute, but it was a dead link. It didn't take people anywhere anymore, and it was a particular source of confusion over the winter months. So we solved that problem by modifying the network. Similarly, up in the northwest corner, It's the corner of 67th Street and 59th Avenue. There was a lot of issues there with driver compliance. Regardless of if it was clearly painted or not, we actually observed motorists blatantly disobeying the paint lines. So this created a lot of concerns over the winter months. It did add to the congestion at this intersection, which is a major intersection in the city. And so we modified it in such a way that we took out the bike lanes, but we left it as a share of the road treatment. Now if you flip to slide 12, I'll start to get into some of the cross-section discussion. Maybe for your ease of reference, you may want to sort of look at slide 8, the map on slide 8. That might help you get oriented. So when I'm talking about 39th Street, that's the east-west major roadway that we put bike lanes on, sort of in the southeast corner of the map on slide 8. As you can see, the top cross-section is the before. It was a four-lane roadway. This road is adjacent to, I think, about three schools, three elementary to middle school age schools. It's residential on both sides of the roadway. And we took this four-lane road, and we actually just closed the outer lanes. And we said, okay, we're going to make this a bike lane area. And what we did is we painted in a 1.6 meter wide gore area, with the remaining being for bike lanes. And if you flip to slide 13, that will actually show you a picture of what it looks like. So it was definitely a source of public feedback. Some people didn't feel that closing the outside lanes was necessary, and they felt things got worse. But we monitored it closely, and it actually didn't affect operations significantly. If you took a look at slide 14, this is the cross-section of 48th Avenue, and that's that north-south running road where we had ultimately removed the bike lanes. Again, this is a sort of a minor arterial road that, before we did anything, it was a four-lane cross-section. And you can see that in the after configuration, what we did is we provided for bike lanes on the outside edges by the curbs. We actually reduced the width of the existing travel lanes to help create the space that we needed. And then at intersections, we created left turn bays. And that way, people traveling through wouldn't be delayed by those left turners. And this is sort of our typical cross-section that we used at intersections and for a certain portion to the north of the roadway. Again, it ran by schools. There was a lot of existing congestion because of drop-offs and pickups of students. It didn't really exacerbate the problem, but this area was a source of confusion because we shifted the center lines. The center line of the road became a big issue throughout the winter, and we resolved it by removing it in 2013. Here's a slide 15 is a picture of what 40th Avenue looks like, not at an intersection, but between intersections, where, again, we had a very similar treatment to the 39th Street. We have that wide painted buffer with bike lanes on the outside. If you flip to slide 16, 48th Avenue goes right through the heart of our downtown. So you can see on the before that there's parking on either side of the roadway. This is very important to downtown residents and businesses. We're well aware of it, so we knew we had to preserve it. Some of the interesting things we did on this were, you can see in the before the travel lanes were 4.9 meters wide. We actually narrowed those all the way down to 3.3, which is very narrow. In fact, most guidelines will maybe suggest you don't go any lower than 3.5. I think that's slowly starting to change. But this is also a bus route. So we actually went out and measured the width of our buses from mirror to mirror to make sure that we would have enough space for a bus to travel down these roads without hitting a bike or, you know, with the mirrors. And it's actually worked very well. The other innovative thing we did here is we had, I think, about 2.4 to 2.5 meters wide parking lane before, and we narrowed that all the way down to 2.2. So you think, oh, well, 300 millimeters, that's a foot. Like, what does that matter? Well, it means a lot when you're retrofitting and you're fighting for space and you're trying to come up with a balance. And it was critical to allowing us to get bike lanes into this roadway. And we actually found that the parking compliance with the narrower parking lane was very, very good. And if you go to slide 17, you'll see exactly that. When the line was painted with the buffer there, the parked cars stuck within the lanes. And it's very clear that everybody's supposed to be on the roadway. So this is a configuration that has worked very well for us. On slide 18, 52 Avenue is again a downtown roadway adjacent to businesses, no residential areas. But this is one where we had to do a modification in 2012. And why I show this is so you can see that there's no one solution to any one of these problems. When you're dealing with bike infrastructure, you actually have a wide variety of solutions. And the trick is choosing the one that's best for you in your situation. So here you can see again, we narrowed travel lanes for motorists to create space for bike lanes. And that's shown in the after the 2012 cross-section in the middle of the page. And then there was some feedback where the businesses wanted it changed back or wanted more provision for their on-street parking. And that's what we modified it to in 2013. We changed it to a share the road. So it's basically a cars and cyclists travel side by side within those 4.2 meter lanes. I guess the big concern here was in 2012 we had removed metered parking on one side of the roadway to help generate enough space for the bike lanes, and that was the issue. And so we restored the metered parking in 2013 and went to a share the lane configuration. Now if you look at slide 19, this is 55th Street, again, one of the removed areas, unfortunately, and I don't have a picture of this because it was installed and removed so quickly that we didn't have a real chance to get a good look at it, but it was, again, four-lane cross-section before, very narrow roadway. Those travel lanes, it's an old road, those are 3.3-meter wide lanes, substandard by today's criteria. So this is an area we're really fighting for space, and what we did is we created a two-way left turn lane in the middle. We basically shut down one of the travel lanes, switched the center line of the road. You can see how the center line of the road has shifted from the before and after cross section, and it's so a two-way left turn lane. You may know it as a suicide lane. It's one of those lanes that runs up and down a road where you can have opposing left turners in the same lane at the same time. So we had some outcry in this area. We ended up removing it. But it's funny, after we removed it, we actually got some calls in saying, we really enjoyed those left turn lanes. It actually made things run smoother. So everybody has a different take on it. Some of the final project stats, everything we did was completed within our budget of $800,000. Of the total 20 kilometers of bike infrastructure installed on our roadways, we're left with 13 kilometers of roadway with bike lanes, 5 kilometers of roadway with bike routes, that's the share the road treatment. I think we had over 450 signs that we installed along these areas. We had over 5,300 online surveys completed and over 500 calls to City Hall. So very ambitious. Some of the challenges, retrofitting roadways is always tricky. Again, like I touched on, we didn't change any curb lines. We had to work within our existing asphalt area, and especially with the budget that we had, it was very very challenging. But we were able to make it work. parking removal was always a key concern. Not only do residents feel entitled to that parking in front of their homes, but we had to be respectful of downtown businesses as well. Temporary nature of construction methods, I think I've already covered that. Same thing with winter conditions and maintenance. I would say maybe I'd even add this, winter should include, you know, spring. Once the snow melts and you have sand all over your roadways, you need to take care of that if you want people to be using your bike lanes or your roadways for cycling, period. Our roadways throughout the wintertime with the cycling infrastructure on it were maintained with the same priority that our council mandates our roadways be maintained. So there's no priority given to bike routes. It was just the normal course of clearing roadways. Industry guidelines. Let's just see here. Industry guidelines. There's a lot of guidelines out there, but if you start doing research and looking at other municipalities, either in Canada or throughout North America, you'll see that there's lack of consistent implementation. This just goes to what I was saying earlier, that there's a lot of different ways to come up with solutions, and you really have to figure out what is the best way for you in your particular context. There's a lot of great guidance, but there's so much different guidance, and there's so many options, it can become confusing. Scope, resourcing, and budget was a huge challenge. We really, in the city, had no dedicated staff full-time to do this project, and it made things more challenging. Same thing with the budget. It was very limited, especially for the length and the size of the work. It would have been better either to scale back the project, unfortunately it would have probably been less impactful, or increase the budget, but either one was not an option at the time, and we did the best you can with what you got. Public feedback was a huge challenge. Like I said, we had over 500 phone calls to City Hall. That was over the space of 2 years, and we had months where we would receive over 100 calls, in a month. And like I said, with no dedicated staff dealing with this 100% of the time, and you know, our engineering department is not that large, it was a huge burden to try and address and respond to all those concerns. Safety is a topic of a huge challenge as well. It was very obvious that there's a difference between what's considered a safe technical treatment versus what the public feels is safe or has a perception of safety. And this is a topic that came up over and over again, and it's a really difficult one to deal with. And then finally, compliance of road users. I think some of the blatant disregard we saw in some areas was surprising to us. We didn't think that would occur. And I think it shows that education and enforcement are just as important as putting stuff on the road. If you don't have the other two pieces, you're really going to create yourself some problems. On slide 22, lessons learned, and again, these are just a snapshot of the challenges and lessons learned, but advanced planning is absolutely critical. If you're thinking of undertaking a pilot such as this, think of how long it'll take, and you probably want to add a year to it. You should probably do, 6 months to a year of hard thinking and planning of the project before you put anything on the roadway. This can go a long ways to helping you troubleshoot problems down the road. Again, context-sensitive design, that no one right solution. I think I've already talked about that. Know your network. What I'm referring to here is the people that live in these communities and the municipalities that run them have a deep understanding of how the roads are used and what is generally acceptable for changing your roadway and what isn't. When you're hiring planners or engineering consultants, like I say, there's a huge bag of tricks to bring to the table, and there's a lot of right ways to do it, but you need that local context to make sure that what's being proposed is right for that area. There's always going to be a trade-off when you're doing something like this between motorists or cyclists. You're basically rebalancing your roadway if you're working within your existing right-of-way. So you have to know what trade-offs are going to be acceptable and will still make your network run appropriately. Consistency and connectivity in the bike infrastructure is really important, not only so that cyclists understand how to use the network and where they're going, but also so that motorists are aware of what's going to happen when a cyclist is in the lane beside them. I think we learned it's important to create facilities that people will use and that not all routes are meant for all users. There's a very wide facility typology out there that basically certain treatments are ideal for novice users. For example, separated cycle tracks. That's probably the safest, most widely accepted type of use where anyone from a child to someone that's elderly can use it and feel very comfortable. However, that's also your greatest infrastructure cost, and you may not have the space to do that. But designing to that level, while that may not be appropriate, going the other way and assuming everybody is a commuter cyclist that cycles around the world is also not appropriate. And it's really, if you want to get the use out of the infrastructure, you should target that middle ground so that it's you get the most bang for your buck. Understand public feedback and trends and be prepared for that. What I mean by that is when you're doing a pilot such as this, there's some general guidelines, sort of, you know, I'm sure many of you might have heard this, where you have those 10% of the public that are early adopters. They love the initiative. You might have those 20% that are hardcore resistors, you know, not in my backyard, I don't want to see it here. But then you have that remaining 70% that are your movable middle. Those are the people that can really make the pilot a success. Those are the people you're trying to engage and see what their palette is for this type of project. And what goes right along with that are using feedback tools that are statistically valid. What I mean by that is we used online surveys throughout the 2 years of the pilot, and we got a lot of great feedback. However, I think it would be fair to say that it was very much those either early adopters or those hardcore resistors that used that as a forum to express their views. Again, we had over 5,300 surveys completed, but our population is over 97,000. What we got back was good information. It definitely helped us out, but it could not be said that it was the true feeling of the public. We did not get that information. So things like you know, random phone call surveys. At least that's something that if you do a method like that to get your feedback, you could say that it is representative of the community, and it doesn't. You don't have people after the fact, for example, in an online survey trying to say that this is representative of the community, when really it's more the special interest groups using it as a forum. Telling the public what you're doing in advance is very important. Anyone directly affected by our pilot, we certainly talk to them before we put anything on the road, but even advanced construction signage saying, look, we're going to be in your neighborhood in the next week installing cycling facilities. I think that type of advance warning could go a long way, and it's something that we did not have the time or the budget to do.
Michael?
Yes.
I'm sorry, this is Kim. I'm just going to ask you to, just because I want to leave a little bit of time for questions, so if we could just wrap up really quickly, that'd be helpful.
Sure, absolutely. I apologize for that.
No, that's okay. I didn't want to interrupt, but...
No, I think the other two are really self-explanatory. Public communication and education is really required. There's a lot of misconceptions out there. And finally, communicating internally with your organizations as well as externally. If you have multiple people that are on the front lines of your projects, you have to make sure that the message is consistent and that everybody's on the same page internally. And with that, that takes me to the end of the presentation.
Michael and Lorna, thank you. That was excellent. I'm just going to unmute the phones now and open it to questions, okay? But thank you. That was really great. Hang on.
The conference is now in talk mode.
Okay, so I'm afraid that we're going to have to limit the questions a little bit. I know that there'll be lots of questions, but I want to leave time for the third presentation. But I think we've got time for three or four questions. So any questions from across the country?
It's John in Vancouver. Do you have any before and after data, or before the pilot and during the pilot on use and safety?
John, yes, actually. We do have, we did counts, cycle counts, throughout all years, 2011, 12, and 13. We did them before infrastructure was installed as well as afterwards. We wanted to gauge what the usage was like. We also did, during the design stage, we hired a consulting engineer to do a peer review of our design from a safety and best practices perspective, as well as another consultant at the end of the pilot to do a user perspective, basically like a road safety audit style. So we did get that feedback. It was found that our infrastructure certainly enhanced safety for cyclists. It didn't really have any major problems with it, just minor tweaks here and there. And yeah, we certainly collected all that data.
Thanks.
Other questions?
So did cycling go up? I'm sorry. This is Karen. I'm just wondering, did your cycle counts go up, Michael?
Karen, yes, they did. The problem is we didn't really have a good sense of where we were starting from. As we added more infrastructure, it was clear more people were using them. But we also, our counting program can't definitively say how many cyclists were in the city before and how many were after. So we do know that it was generally going up, but we can't really say to what degree.
Okay, thank you.
You mentioned about the lane width issue, that 3.5 to 3.7 meters is within the geometric design standards, and you went down to 3.2, and I'm thrilled. I'm wanting to quote you on having done that. But I'm wondering what your reflections are on the current review of the geometric design guidelines and whether you'd be willing to be interviewed about your experience for that review, because that's our struggle with that particular standard, is that it's a guideline, but it's seen as a standard by many of the folks working in transportation engineering, and they just don't feel courageous enough, I guess is the word for it, about going outside of that guideline.
Certainly. I mean, we're always interested in sharing our experience and information. I think it comes back to that context-sensitive design and the fact, like you said, that these transportation guidelines are just that. They're guidelines. They do not prescribe what you have to do. They prescribe best practices and minimum thresholds, and it is up to the designer to have the comfort level to use that flexibility to come up with the right solution for the situation that you're in. And it's tough when developing guidelines like that. They're very broad brush. They're meant for example, the Transportation Association of Canada is meant for all of Canada, so they can't deal with every situation. However, the flexibility is there to make things work for you.
Thank you. We'll be in touch then.
All right.
But we've got a couple of years, so no, you might even have more examples by the time the review's done.
Sure.
I think we have time for one more question. Okay. I think we're going to call it quits on that. But Michael, thank you very much. And Lorna, that was great to have you here. I'm sure if we had more time, people would come up with many more questions. We're going to move on to the third presentation, which is by Sophie Pequin, who's with Montreal Public Health. And so while people are getting her presentation, I'm going to mute you once more, and I will tell you a little bit about her.
You're muted.
The conference is now in silent mode.
Okay, thank you, Kim.
Oh, hang on. Sophie, just, I'm sorry, I just wanted to tell them just a little bit about you. I'll just introduce you for a sec. Sorry about that. Okay, so Sophie has a PhD, and she is an urban planner at Montreal Public Health Department. She's engaged in research and knowledge transfer activities on built environment and public health for municipal and community stakeholders, and she has developed a walkability audit tool to assess the built environment at a local level, and that's what she's going to tell us about today. Thanks very much, Sophie.
Okay, hi everybody. We are glad at the Built and Health Division at the Montreal Public Health Department to present you a produce coming from CLASP 1 project, a walkability audit tool. And this audit tool, named the ODI de Potentiel Piétonnier Actif Sécuritaire, PAS, like STEP, has been used several times since. Next slide, please. One of our built and health goal is to help the municipality, the public authorities, to achieve neighborhood walkability. Next. To evaluate walkability, we use usual indicator. Measure the mixed-use neighborhood, the availability, of local shopping facilities, the housing typology, public institution and school, access to park, green spaces, and access to high-level transit in a distance of 1 kilometer or less. Next. Another usual indicator is a street network and connectivity to go shorter to destination 1 to destination 2. Next. Slide 5. Another usual indicator is residential density. The baseline is a minimum of 35 units per hectare to offer efficient transit and provide a pool of customers to retail shops. Next. But we face two challenges. The first challenge is it takes long term to change walkability based on these indicators in already built neighborhoods. We have to change zoning bylaws, then convince developers, and then build buildings or transform them. Next, slide 7. And according to a suburban or urban resident, active transportation problems are real, but for different reasons. For urban settings, for example, deficient and unsafe pedestrian infrastructures, fear of crime, and road traffic are major problems. But for suburban, deficient and unsafe pedestrian infrastructure, low density, monofunctional land use, weak connectivity. But for both, need to measure built environment to improve it. Next. And okay, we need to build environment, to measure built environment to improve. And for that, we have to promote active transportation and prevent road injuries to enhance safe and active transportation. And we need to do that at micro scale and quickly improvement. But one problem is a limited street and intersection data available in municipal database for Montreal. Condition and functionality of sidewalks or a crime prevention through environmental design features almost not inexistent in database, but they are important to walk. Next, please. The same for the road safety provided by environmental measures. At Montreal, we have few inventories of traffic calming measures. Next. And the challenge, too, is the limited data for these indicators. And we need street and intersection level indicators. Next. In this context, we have developed the walkability audit PAS. It's an observational instrument consisting of systematic, objective, and validated indicators for assessing walkability in a neighborhood or site, for example, a street. 80 indicators are measured. The PAS was validated in Class 1 on 528 streets and intersections. The PAS, the walkability audit, captures the condition and functionality of sidewalks, the safety of all road users focusing on intersections, urban safety, the physical features, ambience and green spaces, the bikeways and physical access to public transit, And plus, by the way, we take the opportunity to observe land use. It's an inventory. Residential density, it's an estimation. And the connectivity, it's an estimation. Next slide, please. Okay, we can see an example, a sample of street segment form. Observations are done on both sides of the street segment, and each crosswalk at the intersection is evaluated. With the form one, for example, we can see intersections are evaluated by form one and street segment form two. Next the slide, please. Data concerning walkability indicators are available for each street segment and intersection, but they can also be combined to provide a more complete diagnosis of the neighborhood's walkability. We have the two options, the two opportunities. Next. We will give you three kinds of examples. The first, the diagnosis of intersections. Next slide, please. Okay, for we have observed an intersection at Berry and Saint-Antoine. Okay, it's two major streets at Montreal. The traffic lights for cars and three pedestrian crossing lights for with countdown display. Four painted pedestrian crossing, two parallel and two zebra, and we can see at the aerial photo. They are well maintained, visible. No parking within 5 meters of the crossing, prohibited by sign, except one side. And good visibility across intersection, and more information is available on the form. Next slide, another kind of diagnosis. The diagnosis of a route, okay? Next. A route between, the walkability audit for the CHUM, the route between hospital and the underground parking, okay? Look at the route is on the dark marking on the map, look, and the picture shows the entrance and the underground parking. It's four street segments and three intersections. Next slide. Some sample of the data can we obtain. Sidewalk, 75 are wide enough, are in good condition, few bumps and cracks, and without permanent obstacles. Half of sidewalks have a buffer space. 50% of buffer space are more than 1 meter, covered by asphalt, cobblestones, and landscaping and street furniture. The street lighting furniture. All the street segments have cobra neck, but 55% of these segments have pedestrian scale lighting, street lighting furniture too. And more information can be collected with the audit. Next slide, please. And if we combine the 80 indicators, we can obtain a diagnosis for the neighborhood. Some example. Thanks. Neighborhood sidewalk width, we can observe that the more than half of the sidewalks have less than 1.6 meters. They are very, not adequate for a large pedestrian crowd. Next. Obstacles on walkway. 48 of sidewalks have a permanent obstacle, like a pole, trees. Another example, next slide. The availability of pedestrian crossing according to street type, according to the road hierarchy, like arteria, collector, and local. And we can see that 52% of arteries have no pedestrian crossing. Next, please. Okay, in conclusion. Next. The usefulness of PA. Okay, we have three major uses of the PA, okay, of the walkability. The first is the walkability diagnosis and identification of problem in the pedestrian perspective. It's important. It's not an usually perspective. It's a very pedestrian perspective. The second is help to mobilization of citizen and public authorities to make change in the short and mid-term. And the main use is to supporting evidence-based decisions because we can collect data for local transportation plan enhancement of urban corridor, improvement of transit-oriented development, transit area, revitalization of neighborhoods, our annual road repair program to identify specific sites and problems. Next. And we have developed the walkability audit toolbox to help people to produce walkability diagnosis to empower the neighborhood and the community-based organization and the municipality professional to use the PAR tool. And the toolbox contains the forms for street segment and intersection, a user manual with a lot of pictures, the database set and template to calculate statistics, a walkability tool with quick user guide, and guideline to write a walkability report. It requires 2-day training session. So far, we have trained since spring 78 stakeholders, NGOs, municipality, and public health professionals. And next, then the last. And we can conclude that the PAP is a tool to support public health objectives and municipal goals aimed at the citizen quality of life. Quick presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to just unmute everybody's line so they can ask questions. Okay, hang on a sec.
The conference is now in talk mode.
Okay. Great presentation. Can I just ask, have you got all of this tool on your website or on a website where we can all access the various tools?
We have the report on the website, but not the toolbox, because it require a 2-day training. And
okay.
But people who have followed the training have the DVD with all the stuff.
Okay. So if other members of class, let's say, wanted to use them, then they would have. Could they do the training with DVDs, or do they need somebody to come in and do the training with them?
Okay.
Actually, yeah.
Sorry about that.
Oh no, it's a good question. I'm Norman King. I'm with Sophie and Céline. It's usually designed for a 2-day session where there's people present who can actually use the tools and answer questions.
Okay.
But it's an interesting question. Mm-hmm. For I'm thinking out loud. Okay, we haven't really discussed this, but I'm asking Sophie actually, is it something that could be just shared with the group to show them, mm-hmm. and we could answer their questions without actually having them use it per se, just to sort of stimulate them in the development of their tools, if
mm-hmm.
they would. Quote where the ideas come from. Is that something that's possible? Or?
Yeah.
Well, we can talk about this a little bit more after the session, but thank you very much. That was great. So questions from other people?
This is Helena. A similar question to John Carsley's question. And have you actually measured the walking in these areas as well as safety?
It's the next project to measure and to measure the walkability audit result and the PAR model the kind of transportation. Yeah, it's the next project.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? And so, while people are thinking, Sophie, when people do the tool, who usually uses the tool? Can it be anybody who's been trained, and is it usually a resident or a professional who usually uses the tool?
We have focused especially on the professional and NGOs leaders, but it's possible for a resident to use it, but if we think about the continuity of the follow-up, the result, it's better to that's professional and community-based organization. Some organized community, you know, organized one.
And are you using this in a formal way in the City of Montreal? Or is the City of Montreal using it in a formal way?
We are in process with them.
Okay.
When you talk about the City of Montreal, are we referring to more at the borough level as opposed to the central city?
I think I'm just kind of curious about, so like, I think I'm not quite clear about the relationship between Montreal Public Health and the City of Montreal. So is this a tool that you're kind of promoting to be used by the city? Are they using it formally themselves, or?
That's a very good question, actually, because in most jurisdictions, public health is part of the municipal structure. From my knowledge, and like Toronto and Vancouver, New York City, whereas in Quebec,
Ontario, in Canada.
I'm sorry.
Hi, Norman. It's John. No, it's in Canada.
Hi,
it's only Ontario that where it's public
I see.
Within
the city
structure. Municipal government.
But here in Quebec, the public health network is part of the provincial government health structure, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
Each administrative region has its public health department. So we work in collaboration with the City of Montreal, try to influence decisions that they make in terms of the planning. And even within the City of Montreal, there are things done at the central level and things done more at the borough level. So we partner with both levels, basically.
Okay.
Hi, I have a question. It's Maureen in Ottawa. I was just wondering, has the tool been used through community groups for mobilization of the community members?
Sophie?
Yes. Sorry, we discussed between us. We use the part three times with three neighborhood communities and with the leaders. And after, they mobilize their people and the leader of the municipality. In three times, the community-based organization use the part.
With the community members?
Yeah.
Okay.
With the you know, we have a marche exploratoire.
An exploratory walk.
And it's good for to mobilize citizens.
Okay.
You know, the walkabout,
you.
Too.
Mm-hmm.
It's good for.
And so maybe to follow on Maureen's question, so will you sometimes do this and then actually submit a report directly to a decision maker or a professional who works in the City of Montreal?
Usually we have association with other organization, community-based organization.
Okay.
But in terms of the city, is it then submitted to the city once?
Wait.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the groups can, in their discussions with the city, will be able to use the result of this audit to further discussion on things that have to be improved to improve walkability.
To help prioritize their list for budget purposes,
correct,
et cetera. That's terrific. Any other questions for Sophie? I think we're there. So are there any other questions for any of the other speakers? Well, we've got like 5 minutes left. Any other questions that people felt like they didn't get to with Michael or with Holly?
One for Michael. Remember you mentioning about the cost of off-road bike lanes as compared to on-road. What do you estimate the difference is? So, I mean, roughly, is it double or triple?
Is Michael still there?
Maybe not. Okay, I can follow up directly. Thank you.
Okay. So I think what we'll do, we'll call things quits here, except that for those of you who are members of Healthy Canada by Design, both Natalie and I would just like to go through some things very quickly. Natalie would like to just talk to people about case studies, which really has more to do with the new health authorities. And then I was just going to give people a very quick update in terms of where we're at with the KTE plan. But again, that probably applies more to the newer health authority. So I think what we'll do is close off the formal part of the presentations at this stage, and I'll just ask those who are in the newer health authorities to stay on the phone for another 10 minutes for Natalie and I to just go through a few things with you. And so otherwise, I'd just like to thank our four speakers for joining us today. That was terrific. I think they were really excellent presentations, very relevant to our work. And thank all of you who've joined us. And again, just if I could have some of the new health authority people stay on with Natalie and I, that would be terrific. Okay?
Thank you. Yeah.
Very much.
Thank
Bye.
You. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.